This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you travel to the desert of Oracle, Arizona, you can still find Biosphere 2. It's an enormous glass terrarium designed to be a replica in miniature of the Earth's ecosystems. It was the setting for this grand experiment in 1991, where eight people were to be sealed into the complex for 2 years to see what they could learn about sustainability and the human impact on the various biomes of Earth. And it was interesting enough and strange enough to capture the attention of the world's media.
Eight scientists are about to be sealed in an eight-story, airtight terrarium.
Shelley Taylor Morgan is standing by at the site at Oracle, Arizona. Hi, Shelley.
Morning. What you're seeing here is the doorway that the eight Biospherians are going to walk into and be sealed into for 2 years.
The futuristic-looking steel and glass structure is touted as an environmental laboratory and prototype for colonies in space.
They'll spend 2 years in their prefab paradise trying to support themselves so that the rest of us can learn what it would be like if we had to move into a portable world on another planet.
Its designers say it's science, its detractors say it's a tourist attraction run by questionable characters.
In his new documentary at Sundance this year, Matt Wolff explores the story behind Biosphere 2. Because there were always these questions of whether this was an actual scientific endeavor or just entertainment. And the reason there were these suspicions is because the idea was conceived by a group of countercultural characters who lived a communal life and were guided by a visionary leader. The film is called Spaceship Earth. And Matt Wolff says it all began for him when he saw a photo of the Biospherians in their jumpsuits.
You know, I do a lot of research online, and I came across this startling image of eight people in bright red jumpsuits in front of this enormous glass pyramid, and I honestly thought it was a still from a science fiction film. But it didn't take me long to realize that this is, in fact, real, and that the inventors and participants of this project are still around, and, you know, I was determined to tell their story immediately.
But what about it? What is this about, or is there something, like, what did you think it was at first?
You know, what appeals to me is that it was a story that was huge in the media that's been lost from collective memory. That's what I'm drawn towards. I call them hidden histories or things that are just ripe for reappraisal. And I recognize that in this story. And as I dug a little deeper, I realized that it's also a story about artists and adventurers and countercultural people. And I'm drawn to that, too. I never thought of myself as someone who does work around science or does work around global warming. But, you know, it all kind of came together in a way that, you know, as I'm making a film, I always ask the question, so what? But also, why now?
Yeah.
And as I started to dig deeper into this story and to realize that it's a story much larger than Biosphere 2, that question of why now became clearer and clearer. And in fact, it felt like there was a kind of urgency to tell this story today.
When did that occur to you that this was about? Because I have to say, I thought it was just going to be this tale of this strange project from the 90s. And the fact that it's so relevant, at least in terms of the way we're thinking about the Earth, that surprised me. When did that occur to you that this was part of the story?
I mean, just I wanted to look at Biosphere 2 as a metaphor, not just literally as a scientific experiment. Mm-hmm. And if eight people go into this model world and they modify their behavior so that they can live in it sustainably and overcome interpersonal difference to coalesce their different skills to make this thing work, I mean, it's a model for how we might do that here on Biosphere 1, which is what they called Planet Earth.
Right.
But I also, as I was making the film, realized that a bigger theme and takeaway from this story is the power of small groups. Mm. The Biospherian Mark Nelson said small groups are engines of change. And that felt like a really provocative and meaningful idea to me. Because in this film, there are two groups. There's what were called the Synergists, the group that came together in the 60s in this commune. And then there's, of course, the eight Biospherians. And they provide a pretty important model of how people can realize unprecedented ideas and accomplish magnificent things through the guise of a small group. And I think that's really instructive right now.
Yeah. Were you surprised at how maybe inspired you became with these people? Because that was one my reaction. I expected to be kind of bemused by it all, but I was so inspired, I have to say, at the end by their idealism then, and even, you know, where they're thinking, how they're thinking now.
It caught me by surprise. I don't think of myself as a filmmaker who traffics in inspiration.
Right.
Or even universality, really. But yeah, it was all there and organic to the material. And, you know, I think I feared at first that the subjects of the film would be defensive. I mean, they were really rebuked and attacked in the media. And I didn't want them to be defensive about their life's work. I wanted to really help translate the vision they had over literally half a century, and to show that there was a coherence towards all of these projects they did leading up to Biosphere 2, and that Biosphere 2 was the ultimate expression of a way of working in the world, and a way of trying to understand how we can live in the future. I mean, these are real futurists. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, their coherence as this group, their sense of commitment and longevity as a collective of people, it's just inspiring. I mean, Kathleen Gray, one of the subjects of the film, says at one point, you know, there are these little openings of opportunity, and that's when you act. And I think the film really has made me, and also people on my creative team, think about what were those moments in our lives where we had an opportunity to cross that threshold, to make important decisions that would characterize the rest of our lives, but also what imprint are we going to have on the world? What can we do beyond talking about things to have an impact?
Yeah. Let's talk about how this all starts. Because the story, as you say, goes back to the 1960s. It all begins in San Francisco. Take us there. Take us to the time. What was the kind of cultural thinking of the time? Because this is important to how this begins.
Yeah, obviously there's the cliche of baby boomer hippies, you know, reimagining the world. But what appeals to me about this group is that they defy stereotypes of hippies and even back to the land counterculture. I'm really interested in things like the Whole Earth Catalog and different counterculturalists from the 60s like Stuart Brand, who were creating connections between technology and sustainability. Someone like Buckminster Fuller became a central figure at the time, and his geodesics and geodesic domes, you know, provided both an architectural but a kind of conceptual model for sustainability. And he was an important influence to the Synergists. In fact, their name, Synergists, came, and their ranch, Synergia Ranch, was inspired by Buckminster Fuller's concept of synergy. And they, one of the first things they did is build a geodesic dome at their ranch, which really is like a commune, even though they don't call it that.
And let's say more about this dome, because I do want to talk a little bit about it as a visual element of the film, because this was important to you. You wanted us to see elements of this concept kind of throughout the film, visually in some way.
Absolutely. Yeah. This idea of a geodesic dome is that, you know, individual components aren't as powerful as the struts of the ball all coming together. And I think of that as a metaphor for filmmaking, too. I mean, I'm interviewing lots of different people to get different perspectives, but the kind of composited storytelling of all these individuals is what kind of creates a larger narrative that expresses bigger ideas. So it's not just this happened and then that happened. I'm always trying to find a kind of interpretation that tells a bigger whole to all these little fragments and pieces of a Byzantine story like this. Yeah. And, you know, visually, I worked in kind of little geodesics in our interviews, for instance. We traveled around the country interviewing people with a collapsible geodesic kit that set up in blurry backgrounds behind our interview subjects. But, you know, I'm really inspired by this symbol of the geodesic dome, because it's not just an aesthetic thing. It's also a form of technology, and it's also ideology, and it all finds expression in Biosphere 2 in a really, you know, unique and theatrical way.
Yeah. Theater is an important part of it. I want to get to that here in a moment, but you mentioned Kathleen Gray. She talks about in those early days, she's in San Francisco, and she's reading this book by a French spiritualist, the conceiving of this world where they can it's a kind of a communal project. It's this idea. And then she meets this and a crucial character in the story, John Allen. Talk a little bit about this moment when they meet and they sort of conceive of this, at least the origin of this idea.
Yeah, I mean, Kathleen Gray is an incredible storyteller, and she sets up a figure who will be key to understanding the story of Biosphere 2, but also this larger story, and that's John Allen. He fits the prototype of your gregarious countercultural leader, but he comes from a peculiar background as this Okie who served in the military and studied geology and
got an MBA from Harvard.
Exactly. Yeah. He's not your prototype for a countercultural leader. He right. is different, even though he has some of the characteristics of what might be considered even a cult leader, even though he's certainly not that. And you get the sense of magneticism from him. And later in the film, Kathleen talks about these moments of opportunity where you act. And right at the beginning of the film, it becomes clear that this chance meeting between Kathleen and John Allen, where she's reading Mount Analog, and he suggests that they actually do what this group of people envision to do, that's that moment of opportunity for her. And it's what precipitates a larger group of people coming together to pursue what's really a lifetime experiment.
I read where you said you were interested in, and this is how you put it, an outsider visionary figures who beg for reappraisal. I guess John Allen fits perfectly into that.
Yeah, and the other thing that's, I mean, what's unique about this group and makes them quite distinct is that they were idealists who went back to the land, but they were capitalists. It's a real neoliberal model in a sense. They wanted to holistically integrate technology and ecology and to create enterprises that could be sustainable both ecologically and economically. And it's a futurist model that we find, you know, to be very mainstream today. People like Elon Musk, who are quite, you know, literally pursuing Mars colonization as a private venture. And I think John Allen, in addition to being a kind of archetype of a countercultural leader, is also in some ways the kind of cult of personality behind startups and dot-com corporations, except decades ahead of that moment because of his interest and savvy in business, but also his, you know, his idealism and his intellectually voracious point of view in terms of pursuing these futurist projects. So, you know, in a lot of ways, I think ultimately the category he fits into is futurist.
Well, you mentioned Kathleen Gray and something that she says in the film, and I wanted to play that moment. They were a group of these young, energetic idealists who basically wanted to find a new way to live.
People were doing all sorts of things at that time. There were a lot of people starting collectives, communes, and we wanted to last. So we didn't take drugs. That would kind of blow it. If one wants to make a contribution to history, you notice those moments of opening, and that's when you act. We sat down in the living room. What is it that we're going to do? Well, we could do theater, we could do art, we could do business, we could do science, we could do... And then somebody said, let's do all of it. Okay.
So she mentions this theater. Theater is a really important element in the way John Allen thinks of things. And I wanted to ask a little bit about that. The idea of engaging, improvising, performing, what is the theater part of all of this as John Allen is thinking about it?
Well, I think Kathleen Gray and John Allen both talked about theater as a mode of simulation, simulating archetypal type situations and positions in the world, but also managing group dynamics, managing... you know, a sense of improvisation and play, as you say, but also the energy that brings together people and gives them the power to keep pursuing things. It ignites the fire in the belly. And I think theatricality was always part of that futurist vision as well. You know, I think there was an idea that theater could draw people into these complex ideas as well.
I think it's interesting, too, that there's something that this ecologist, Tony Burgess, says. in the film. And this comes a little bit later, but he does mention this idea of theater, and I wanted to ask about it. It really gets to Tony's impressions of John Allen's leadership gifts and his sense of human nature. Let me play this other moment from the film.
John Allen was a brilliant, charismatic leader because he simply met emotional needs. He was a mind musician. He really knew what people needed and tried to motivate them by supplying it or withholding it sometimes. I thought part of John Allen's genius was helping people to realize it's all theater.
And one impression of that could be that it's theater, so it's artifice, so it's not real. But that's not what he meant, right? I mean, theater in a more substantial way. And it seemed to be the key to the way John was thinking about, as you said, these group dynamics, I guess.
I think that part of John's gift as a leader is that he, you could say, led from behind. He really empowered people to see their potential and to do things that they never conceived that they could do. And so, you know, I think in a way, the metaphor of backstage director versus performer on the stage is apt. It's he pushed people into the spotlight with this particular project, and he empowered them to do highly visible and ambitious things that enter the public realm. You could call it the world stage. And that sense of play and theatrics is part of what drew people in. It's, I think, part of what attracted people to literally make pilgrimages to the biosphere. And by doing that, people, you know, were confronted with a kind of ecological model that raised bigger questions and gave them access to bigger ideas. Ultimately, I think, because of the theatricality of the project and because of John's unconventional background, people questioned the veracity of what was happening in there scientifically. Yeah. But that as this kind of backstage leader, he really pushed people to fully realize their potential. And in the case of Biosphere 2, it became something on the world stage.
John Allen seemed to be interested in, I guess, this kind of constant momentum with his ideas. And they leave San Francisco, they establish a ranch in New Mexico, and then it's on to the next realm. And to increase the challenge, they go to the coast, Northern California, to Berkeley, and build a ship. What was that about?
I mean, and this is an example of something that when you discuss it, it seems like it makes no sense. But when you watch the film, you're like, oh yeah, of course they went to the Bay Area to build an enormous concrete junk ship with no practical skills to do that.
Right.
But they do. And I think a lot of that reinforces an important theme in the film, which is about human achievement and the possibilities, but also the limitations of that. And I think when I first saw footage of them building the ship and then launching the ship, it's incredibly emotional. I was crying watching the footage because it really is magnificent that a group of people could figure out how to do something and that by doing it, they become what they call planetary people. They have the ability to be truly free, to engage in a kind of voyage into the unknown, which is that metaphor of the book Mount Analog that Kathleen was reading. And it enables them to increase the stakes and the ambition of what they're doing and to really take on the world piece by piece. And it was that kind of practical experience that they needed to pursue something as crazy and wild as Biosphere 2.
So they exert all of this energy and all of this work and really just blind faith, and they launch this ship, head out to test it into the San Francisco Bay, as we'll see. And here's another moment from the film. This is William Dempster and Marie Harding.
We sailed out from San Francisco Bay, sailed out under the Golden Gate Bridge. And when we got out in the ocean, the waves were huge, literally 25 to 30 feet high.
Thing was tied down the way it should have been. The radar broke and fell in the ocean.
We certainly were learning quickly, yes.
And for some reason, I wasn't afraid. And I don't think anybody was afraid. It was one of those transitional, transformative moments, indeed. Well, now we were free.
That moment always gives me the chills, and as you can imagine, I've seen this film hundreds of times.
Yeah. I have to say, you know, the beautiful part of it, too, is when that, as Marie mentions it, that bow does come up and you realize. Because I have to say, I wondered, is that thing going to sink? Do they even know if this thing is going to float?
Yeah, I mean, their projects start in modest terms, building a ranch, and they continue to up the ante. And at this point, they're pursuing a project with real life and death stakes. Yeah. I mean, that might sound dramatic, but if they screw up and make a ship that sinks, people could be in harm's way. They're entering this torrential storm with their giant boat. People could die.
Yeah.
And I think upping the stakes like that is so true to their philosophy. And it became quite, you know, the issue with Biosphere 2 as well. If we lock up these eight people, you know, they could completely run out of oxygen and food. So they weren't afraid of taking things to the extreme. But also, there was a certain sense of confidence and bravado, this idea that you can learn by doing.
Yeah.
It's another big takeaway for me, too, is you don't have to go to school or be the definitive expert on something to figure out how to accomplish your goals. And that this ethos of learning by doing is really empowering.
But it's so interesting the way that comes in conflict with this idea, and probably still of the time, that you have to have credentials, that the science has to be completely settled before you do anything like this. I mean, they were going into this biosphere experiment with the idea that it was an experiment. We're not sure quite how it's going to work. But people had these expectations that they should have had it all figured out. And that seemed like an important theme in the film.
Yeah, I mean, academic scientists aren't going to be really impressed with the idea of taking a journey into the unknown.
Right.
And what they were doing was vanguard. I think that's where the knowledge that they are artists and adventurers comes into focus as well. You know, conventional science or small scale science, they have a hypothesis and they go in there and try to seek particular answers to really predetermined questions. And this was a different kind of model of science, total systems science, in which you go in and you observe and you collect data. And it's okay if things don't work because this is designed to be a 100-year experiment. Mm-hmm. And if things go wrong, they'll learn and they'll keep improving upon the system they've designed. And there wasn't a strong precedent for that in the academy or within governmental organizations. This was a private enterprise. And again, if you think about that dot-com model of quote-unquote disruption, you know, that's what they were doing. They were, you know, pursuing this knowledge both in a proprietary way, but in a vanguard way that couldn't have been achieved with the speed and with the experimentation through conventional institutions.
Here's another moment from the film. This is Tony Burgess.
John Allen had suggested, well, the whole point of this is not to do rigorous science from the get-go. The point of this is to learn how to make a biosphere that can support human occupants in an extraterrestrial setting. It won't work the first time. It probably won't work for the first several times, but each time we're likely to learn more faster.
The question comes up, how are you going to pay for all of this? And as you mentioned, and this was an interesting twist, as you said, this wasn't just a commune that was quite capitalistic, as John Allen himself says. We were about making this work. And so talk a little bit about this, and let's bring another character into the story, Ed Bass.
Well, the Synergists had met somebody named Ed Bass early on in their activity, and he came from a prominent family of oil scions, and he was an outsider to that kind of culture and was a dedicated environmentalist and I would say also a futurist as well. And they formed a unique kind of alliance where he would provide the capital for the Synergists to pursue unusual projects in different parts of the world, or in different biomes, as they would say, whether it was a hotel in Kathmandu, an art gallery in London, thousands of acres of grasslands in the Australian outback, and they would improve the kind of resources and value of these properties. So there was a kind of idealistic but also business model to this relationship with Ed. And then he became the sole investor of Biosphere 2 to the tune of $200 million. So he was a risk-taking visionary himself, and he really believed in the vision of this group and was willing to invest in it. But there was a business model, as out there as it seemed. They aimed to develop Biosphere 2 to develop proprietary knowledge and technology to facilitate Mars colonization.
Yeah.
And to create closed systems that, as Tony says, could support human occupants in an extraterrestrial setting. But they also believed that what was being learned inside Biosphere 2 would enhance people's ability to create sustainability, whether it was green technology or scientific knowledge. That was very open-ended, but you know, Ed was and continues to be a very generous and committed environmentalist. And I think that this fusion between technology and industry and ecology is consistent with the work that this group had been doing. But that kind of futuristic, visionary, incredibly expensive work is only going to happen with really a benefactor.
Yeah. It's interesting that they were having these conferences in the early days, when they were sort of breaking down different biomes throughout the country, throughout the world, and then they were thinking about this holistically as the whole Earth and the whole, you know, the whole world view. And this is when they get to these conversations that I have to say, as I'm seeing this in the film, are extremely relevant today, remarkably prescient. They're talking about climate change in the late 80s or the mid 80s. Can't imagine anyone was talking about that, at least not in sort of a mainstream way like they were. And they're talking about air and water pollution, all of these destructive forces. I mean, that was, I have to say, it was kind of amazing that they were talking about it in those terms then.
Exactly. It was actually the early 80s.
Right.
So this is
81,
real.
Those conferences, I think, started, right?
These conferences are kind of like proto-TED conferences,
yeah,
in which they kind of network with the intelligentsia, both in culture and science and technology, and bring them together for these conferences at their property in the south of France. And again, it wasn't just about talking about ideas. I think these were think tanks, in a sense, about doing projects to continue their goal of creating technology and ecology that sustainably coexists. And to see them making their own film, Marie Harding directed a film called Man, Earth, and Challenges. You see a lecture that in a very prescient way describes the catastrophic consequences of climate change. And this is in the early 80s, and it's really astounding. And I think if I were just to describe that hotel in Kathmandu, that art gallery in London, and Australian outback grasslands, it seems random.
Yeah.
But when you see that these experiences, that these projects are coming together in these conferences, that they are coalescing this knowledge through direct hands-on experience and putting it into the context of climate change and seeking a major project that could grapple with the consequences of that, it's undeniable that they are ahead of the curve, and that they're thinking about ways to remedy urgent problems, but also just to understand them and to bring awareness to them. And that it's really part of the reason why I think people are going to find that there's this kind of enhanced urgency to this story, yeah, which has been discounted, because I think sometimes people didn't want to deal with the questions that Biosphere 2 is raising.
Yeah. Well, just thinking about what's happening now, you know, rising sea levels, all these fires in Australia. I mean, all of that comes to mind when you're watching this film.
Exactly. And thinking about distilling those threats and distilling those challenges into a microcosm, and to understand that at the core, of these problems are humans, and that humans have the ability to modify their impact when they see the consequences of their actions. And inside Biosphere 2, that effect was accelerated in an extreme way. And it was also, you know, in a terrarium that people could go and observe themselves. So the metaphor of it is almost as potent as the actual activity that was happening inside.
Yeah. Let's talk about the idea of the Biosphere. Where does the concept come from? How does space come into play? And maybe we should mention this film that I had forgotten about from 1972, Silent Running. I'm not sure how much it inspired the idea, but it did seem to be something that was in the air at the time, I guess.
Yeah, in the 1970s, there was a burgeoning awareness about catastrophic environmental issues. I mean, this is the era in which, the EPA was formed. And alongside that, there was also a kind of string of science fiction films that imagined apocalyptic scenarios as a result of environmental catastrophe. And Silent Running is a very potent example of that, where Bruce Dern is a kind of astronaut in a closed ecological system that's floating in space. And when Mission Control demands that he explodes this new miniature world, he goes rogue and cuts ties and, you know, gravitates into space, into the unknown in this miniature world where he is a steward of all these plants and little bunny rabbits. They're wearing bright red jumpsuits. It's, yeah. It's almost as if it was like the model for Biosphere 2, although it wasn't. There was this sense that there was an almost science fiction scenario of the catastrophe and destruction of Earth because of the environment in the late 70s. And I learned even then that Stuart Brand, this 60s figure who published the Whole Earth Catalog, he was also hosting conferences about Mars colonization. But this was really fringe stuff back then, this idea that you might have to escape planet Earth, but that in the process of doing it, maybe you'd get some ideas about how to save it.
Yeah. Here's another moment from the film. This is Kathleen Gray again.
Nobody was building a long-term life system to go into space. No one was doing that. We thought, here's a niche. Let's go for it. When you even visualize a colony off the planet, suddenly you're rethinking what's possible.
Say more about that, if you would, because this is a really important theme, that the stakes here are real. You get a sense, if you go into a place like this for the controls, the limitations, your actual impact. I mean, that was one of the things that comes up time and time again in this film.
I mean, something worth noting is that the theater company that Kathleen Gray and John Allen founded was called the Theater of All Possibilities. And this kind of whimsical notion of all possibilities characterizes all of the work that this group does. And I think it's the engine of change that really motivates them to continue upping the ante, pursuing more and more ambitious projects. And again, I think what was so inspiring to me is that it is so easy to talk about ideas, to discourse, and it is often so difficult to actually put those ideas into motion through tangible projects. And that's really a result of cynicism, the limitations of commerce and politics, institutional pushback. And this group, because perhaps of their commitment to a theater of all possibilities, looked beyond that and acted beyond that. They had the resourcefulness, the ambition, and the skills to do that, but there were limitations to that and pushback.
Just talk a little bit about the scale and the scope of creating this. I mean, again, they have the funding, they have the benefactor, a rich oil billionaire from Texas. But the scope of it, and I think the term biblical comes up, going out to get the right creatures to put here and getting the right, I mean, just say something about that, because we see that in the film.
I mean, it is almost like Noah's Ark. They they employ, you know, experts from various disciplines and present this unique challenge to distill the fundamental characteristics of every biome, a rainforest, an ocean with a living coral reef, a desert, grasslands and marshes, and I mean everything but a glacier. And these specialists are kind of put into an interdisciplinary setting to think about a chain of reactions between all of the plant life and animals and technology that would be necessary for this system to exist holistically. And the biospherians and the synergists, but also these expert ecologists or ethnobotanists and all sorts of thinkers and doers go around the world to collect literally thousands of species of plants to create rich soils and to transport a coral reef from the Bahamas. And just imagine the amount of technical preparation and consideration to transport living coral reef from the Bahamas to the Arizona desert and to plant that in an ocean. I mean, if that ocean didn't have mechanical waves, algae would grow over everything and kill it. And you know, there had to be temperature control and fog machines and wind, all sorts of things that could sustain life. And I think there is a kind of biblical dimension to that, a kind of Eden that they were creating. And within that Eden, there was a certain kind of a sense of reinvention, a sense of peace, but also the threat of danger and the threat of destruction.
Yeah. So this media narrative starts to emerge that you explore. A lot of suspicions. You know, was this real science? Is this just kind of trendy entertainment? And then the idea that, and the fact that this idea was born on a commune, and this dark image starts to come into play. You show one, I think it's NBC News expose, that was really dark and conspiratorial about this idea of this group as a commune and John Allen as a cult leader. What do you make of the fact that this idea emerges? Was it just sort of suspicion or sensationalism? And what do you think happened there?
I mean, this group didn't expect that the media would take interest in what they're doing, which I think is incredibly naive. They were doing a monumental, highly theatrical project, and the media obviously grabbed onto that. I mean, it's undeniable that they were also putting on a show as much as they were pursuing this rigorous project. And as that media interest grew and became national and then international, it was sort of on them to define the terms of this project. And it was conceived of as an experiment in the traditional sense. And also some kind of ground rules came into focus, like it or not, for them. And that was that nothing would come in and out. And that they would be hermetically sealed for 2 years and completely subsist on the natural atmosphere and food inside. And that was a mistake. I think the complexity of this project and its kind of multi-tiered goals is lost in defining those ground rules. And this is, you know, before Big Brother and the real world, but in a lot of ways, I think the media, they shaped something that was a form of entertainment in which it was this kind of, bell jar in which people could see these groups of people infighting and, trying to subsist, you know, almost like the television show Survivor. But leading up to the experiment, I think people started to dig deeper as this became a bigger story.
Yeah.
And they didn't find traditional academic credentials. They found this unconventional group of self-trained ecologists and engineers and ecologists and theater performers, and that raised skepticism. And I think that was unfair. And I think people were looking to sensationalize the story, but there were some missteps from the management of this project as well. When you become newsworthy, you need to be transparent. You need to allow journalists to have the maximum amount of information so that they can tell this story to the masses.
Yeah.
And was
John Allen a little too controlling? Were they a little too secretive? Were they not as transparent as they could have been or should have been? I mean, that comes up as well.
I think so. And I think this is where this tension between private enterprise or proprietary science as intellectual property versus government or academic projects that are seeking public knowledge, that tension comes into play. And I think in a somewhat defensive way, the management said, this is proprietary knowledge. We can't share everything with you. But as soon as you shut down transparency and access to the media, I think it stokes incredible skepticism, but also a sense of suspicion. And that as that suspicion increased, the management probably mismanaged that by becoming more and more inaccessible.
The ecologist Tony Burgess says something really interesting in the film, and I wanted to play this moment because it gets at how, at least how he believes, there's always, as he describes it, this cult-like atmosphere in big projects at first. Here's another moment from the film. You're asking John Allen, for example, hear him first, if he felt attacked by all of this media coverage.
Did you feel attacked?
Well, I was attacked, but I didn't feel it that I was. Here is your brainwashing cult leader.
I'm sure John felt a huge amount of discomfort at having his accustomed role as director of the drama threatened. Frankly, I don't know any human organization that does an innovative startup that doesn't have cult-like aspects, especially in the corporate sector. We are hardwired to create cults in the innovative phase of an organization.
I think it's worth noting that while Tony is saying that, you see them doing a very culty theater exercise that is definitely, I think, for people who don't take an interest in avant-garde theater, I think it would look like cult activity.
Yeah.
And this is a peculiar and eccentric group. What they're doing isn't going to translate to mainstream news, per se. And I think there's a kind of protectiveness amongst this insular and cohesive group from having that exposed and taken that out of context.
Yeah.
But, you know, there is a cult of personality that surrounds John Allen. When I was speaking to everybody about the power of small groups, this model of small groups as an engine of change, they all agreed there needs to be a leader.
Yeah.
And John Allen was that leader, and he was a charismatic figure, but he could be a little evasive as well. And I think in the film, some viewers might expect him to be a nefarious figure. But at the end of the day, I don't think there's anything evil going on. There's no abuse. And I think there are issues of control.
Sure.
But, you know, Tony speaks to the fact that there always is a cult of personality around an innovative project. I mean, Elon Musk, Steve Jobs.
I mean, name them. Yeah, go down the list of any of these startups.
And oftentimes those people can be a little problematic as well as visionary.
Yeah, yeah. Lots of things go wrong. There are infestations, plants die, there's too much carbon dioxide in the air, they lose weight, they're lethargic at times because they haven't gotten quite the atmosphere just working out. But in the end, as they're coming out, it seems like the impression left with the public was that it was a just unmitigated failure and disaster. But in the film, we hear from some of the Biospherians, and they have these really fond feelings for the experience, even though it wasn't, as you say, perfect.
Yeah, they fell in love with the biosphere. I mean, that's kind of what we all need to do, is we have to fall in love with the natural world to treat it respectfully. And I think a big thing I think about with failure is when things don't get finished. As a filmmaker, you know, I might make a film that people don't generally like, but if I finish it, I will learn something about filmmaking. I'll understand new things through the reactions of audiences. But if I never finished that film, it's basically a failure, and it wouldn't give me the confidence to ever make anything again. And so when I look at Mission 1 of Biosphere 2, a lot of things failed. A lot of things didn't go as planned. And a lot was learned by that. But that these Biospherians who committed to going on a two-year mission, they finished what they set out to do. And to me, that is a success. But, you know, they could have easily have walked out of the airtight door. Nobody was going to let them die inside. They had that option, but they didn't, because they fell in love with the biosphere, and they were committed to finishing what they started, even if it didn't go as planned, because they were learning. But that's a lot of nuance, particularly when the communication around the project has been set up so strictly around this idea of the enclosure.
Yeah.
If you're watching Survivor, the reality show, you know, you're in or you're out.
Yep.
You win or you lose. And I think
that is the perspective we had. A lot of people take to this, right? That it's a reality TV thing.
Yeah, or it's a competition.
Or it's a competition, yeah.
It's a competition. Or it's a science experiment.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, people had different ideas of what this thing should be, and it existed somewhere in the middle of all of them. But if you are looking at it as a science experiment, no, there's not a hypothesis. There's not a reproduced set. If you're looking at it as a reality TV show, why isn't it a reality TV show? I mean, they were being observed and picked true. Apart by the media outside, but they were there to do much more complex things than to sit around a house arguing with each other right. And having romantic liaisons.
So I wanted to ask you, at the core was this idea of making the stakes of life in the planet seem real for these people. And here's a moment where Mark Nelson talks about this really well in the film. This is him talking the day they leave the biosphere and in a conversation with you.
To live in a small world and be conscious of its controls, of its beauty, of its fragility, of its bounty, and its limits changes who you are.
When you're out in what seems to be almost this infinite biosphere, so big, so large, so tall, it's kind of easy to think that your actions don't count, but they do count.
I have to say that little line gives me the chills to changes who you are. That sense of personal transformation through lived experience that is the result of decades of inquiry and exploration. I mean, it's very emotionally potent to me, but it's also very practical.
Yeah. Are there any biosphere experiments going on today? Did anyone learn anything practical from that experiment, or was it seen as a failure? I mean, anything happening today now because of that?
Well, you know, ultimately, Biosphere 2 was taken over by a corporate consultant, and it was sold to the Columbia University, who did meaningful climate-related research that proved some stuff about coral bleaching and high levels of carbon dioxide. But it wasn't a closed system. They split up all the biomes into individual sections where small-scale science was pursued. And when Columbia was done with it, they sold it to the University of Arizona. And the University of Arizona is doing interesting climate science. In fact, just a few weeks ago, they finished an experiment where they quarantined the rainforest and simulated a drought to better understand how droughts will affect rainforest ecology. But I think in terms of the biospherians we meet and the mission that we cover, you know, there was an incredible amount of data that was observed and collected during the mission, and that data is missing. It's really unfortunate because so much of the knowledge that was gleaned in there was lost when this project was taken over by a corporate consultant, and nobody knows where it is. And to me, this question of success or failure is very nuanced, but in one way, the ultimate failure of Biosphere 2 is that it was repurposed. Instead of being that closed system it was so rigorously designed to be, it was turned into a more conventional instrument. And in some ways, that is a failure. And it is a failure that the data that was collected during the mission hasn't been accessible for research. But in so many other ways, I think the project is a success. And, you know, it provides a model in which we might not only learn about science, but demonstrate a model of accountability and action amongst ourselves.
It's Matt Wolff. He directed the documentary film Spaceship Earth, which is showing in the U.S. documentary competition at Sundance this year. And there's one screening left. It's tonight at 6 at the Redstone Cinemas in Park City. You can get the details on our website, radiowest.org. We should thank the people at Bill White Farms in Park City. That's where we recorded our Sundance conversations this week. Thanks also to our intern, Natu Twe. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard, Tim Slover, and Ali Vallarta. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.